London Business School works with the London Alumni Club to deliver insightful and valuable events for the LBS community. In this session, Brand Power, The Art of Survival, Nader Tavassoli, Professor of Marketing at London Business School, held a fireside chat with Anne Cairns, Executive Vice Chairman of MasterCard.
I am Nader Tavassoli. I am a faculty member in the marketing department here at London Business School, and I have been for 17 years. So I've been here for a long time. My background, as for many, is very diverse. Germany, Iranian growing up, but you can judge by the accent. After high school, I spent some time in the US. And Anne's background is even more colorful in terms of where she's lived.
I don't know about the word colorful.
we had a nice discussion. She's the executive vice chairman of MasterCard, which, just talking to Anne yesterday, it was a fascinating background on the brand. Despite having done my research, it's a brand that in 2006 IPO'd at $5 billion. Not so bad. It is trading at about $230 billion in terms of market cap today. So if you had been smart enough to invest in one of these upstart companies in 2006, you would have had a very nice return. But it's actually the reason we designed the panel today, and maybe I'll spend a brief moment on it. We took two very, very diverse brands. We took Cobra Beer, as you know, which is a tiny little brand, a niche brand in many ways. And it's in a sector which is a very old space, but it's going through some very turbulent times in terms of all the craft beers, lots of mergers, and so forth. So we thought it would be really interesting to look at how this little brand navigates these sort of, you know, unsteady waters, I would say. And they sort of had the reverse Brexit in 2011 when they merged or were acquired by Molson Coors. I think it's been very good for the bottom line of the brand. So they'd always had tremendous growth before that. But MasterCard, if you know the payment space, of course, that is a space everybody is gunning for. And just learning the role the brand has played, and I'm sure some of this will come out in our discussion, will be very useful. So it's very turbulent times in that space. And we'll talk about both the opportunities that you can take advantage with a brand like MasterCard, but also some of the threats. You know, you can think of the great growth, but you have a lot to protect at this stage. So how do you approach it? And where we can really bring out this idea of brand. So I was asked to say a few words about brand, and I just spent 7 hours with the senior executive program doing exactly that. So I'll just start you guys off the way I started them off. I'm going to give you just a simple word, and I'm going to ask you to name a brand, or the brand you can think of, because that'll kind of define what a brand is. And I think many of you will know the answer to this, but the word is safe. Which brand comes to mind?
Volvo.
Everybody says Volvo, right? So what I've given you is a trademark, which is the brand in terms of a legal sense. You own the brand name Volvo. And what's come to mind or is safe. And Volvo is so strong that the link between the association and the word is so strong, I can give you the association. Another brand might be, I'll give you the word, the association is magical.
Disney,
right? So it's very much, very, very strong link in people's minds. So at the simplest level, a brand is two things. One, it's an asset that you own, which is a trademark, and the other, it's a set of associations. And when we talk about brands when they're strong, it simply means it's a widely recognized trademark. MasterCard's unaided recognition is about 80%. So it's like the McDonald's arches, even in black and white, when you test those circles, they just even drop their name. So you don't even need the name anymore in this mobile environment. So the brand asset, the logo in a sense, also has some value. And of course, then the question is, well, what sits behind? What is the association you have with the brand? And how does it help us in these turbulent times? So going back a little bit in the history books, brands and their significance really emerged in the Industrial Revolution, when you started separating where goods were made and where they were consumed. So people wanted to know, where did they come from? Whom to hold responsible? They were really, in many ways, a trust mark. And of course, now it's not just trust. They have much meaning that sits behind the brand. And at London Business School, our rebranding is not a visual exercise in terms of visual identity. It's very much about also delivering on the promise and who we are. It links it to our heritage. And it kind of defines the space we want to compete in the world, and the kind of people we want to attract to be part of that as well. So that's a little bit on the background of brands. And then tomorrow morning, I'll talk to the senior executives about, you know, well, what's the value of brands? And some of you have been involved in mergers and acquisitions in the US since 2001, in the rest of Europe since 2005. You now have to value the brand as an intangible asset on your balance sheet when the brand is acquired. This came because of the dot-com bubble, when these transactions had, you know, this huge, you know, valuations of, you know, 90-plus percent goodwill, which is basically all the stuff we can't value goes into goodwill, which is a good chunk of CEO ego that goes with that as well. And in many cases, especially in the consumer goods industry, it is the single largest identifiable asset on the balance sheet, right? So if you're buying a brand, big chunk is goodwill, but next, as an asset, often comes the brand, depending on the space. What's interesting is that that only recognizes the separable aspect of a brand. So the brand as a separable asset, something you have legal ownership for, and you can sell or you can rent out in terms of a licensor, for example. But the value of the brand actually goes way beyond that. So I was asked to mention a little bit about my research. So I look at the value the brand brings, not just to customers. So the way they value it, if you're buying a brand, so when Cobra was bought by Molson Coors, the value of the brand on the balance sheet was actually larger than the price of the acquisition because it came with a bunch of liabilities. But that's only the difference it makes from, you know, the beer, the product, and what the name does in terms of future cash flow discounted to the present. But actually, if you think about a brand, London Business School, it goes way beyond just attracting students. And when I joined London Business School in 2002, I came from MIT. And back then, one of the promises to me was, you can help build a great school. Our goal is to become number one in the FT rankings. And you know, I'm sitting in Cambridge, Massachusetts going, who are you? Number one in which ranking? And I thought sort of, that's a bit of an ambitious goal. And how are we really going to do that? And we ended up doing it, right? And we were number one in the rankings for a while. And of course, that's not just the brand. There's a lot behind it. Now we have some of the top faculty in the world calling us up, wondering if they can spend a sabbatical with us, maybe with an eye on employment. So on the employment side, right, we can attract far better people and we don't have to pay them to be here, meaning we don't have to pay above the odds. It turns out the business schools that pay the highest salaries are not the top schools. It's kind of the sort of the mid-range schools because they have to pay to get the top talent if they can even attract them. We can also think of brand. Some of my finance colleagues are looking at the power of brand, and you can think of your cost of capital, which is greatly reduced if you have a powerful brand. Why? Because as an investor, you know strong brands in turbulent times, the earnings volatility is far less extreme for strong brands. Smoother earnings, more loyal customers, and strong brands tend to invest in the times of downturn. So in that sense, if your business is very capital hungry, which we are too, by the way, despite our small size, it really gives you a much lower cost of capital because of the lower risk. So actually, if you think about the drivers of your business, when we talk about branding, the real way to think about branding is, what is my business model? What is the business I'm driving, and where in my business does brand provide leverage? So where can I use it to, you know, accelerate, you know, sort of my capital, lower the cost of capital, attract the right kind of talent? And I know for many companies, the war on talent, it's very tough to get the right people to your company. So it's really to think beyond just the customer when we think about brands. So in that sense, I'm hoping we can also sort of talk about MasterCard's business model and really think about where the power of brand comes in. I think we all know it when we recognize the logo, whether it's, you know, in the advertisements or when we're sitting, I was coming over here in a black cab, you know, and there's the MasterCard logo, which somehow, whether I notice it or not, might affect me to take my MasterCard out of my wallet and use it to pay versus another card, that's as a customer, but in terms of partnerships working with MasterCard, in terms of MasterCard's cost of capital, in terms of attracting talent, the brand plays a significant role there as well. So with that said, a bit of an introduction to what brands are and as a backdrop to our discussion. And I'd like to ask Anne, and we had this discussion yesterday, just to tell us a little bit about the story of the business and maybe to think about the brand, the role it played. I'll ask a few follow-up questions, but then we'll leave plenty of time for the audience both to ask Anne, not just about MasterCard, she's very experienced in business in general, and I'm happy to take some questions as well. Okay, Anne.
Thank you, Nader. So yesterday we were talking about MasterCard, and actually, you know, I told Nader the IPO story about we IPO'd in 2006 at $5 billion. I actually think at that time investment bankers didn't really truly understand the value of payment businesses, which is quite interesting. Subsequently, we've seen something very different happening across the business community. And of course, the market cap of the company is now significantly bigger. And if you actually think about who we are and what we do, we're not a credit card company. What we are is a big global technology network that actually moves money around the world in real time across 210 countries. So it's absolutely massive in terms of global reach. And it's very different from what might leap to your mind as a consumer about what we do. And if you think about us, we're a B2B2C business. We don't sell directly to you, the person in the street. We sell to banks, we sell to corporations. You know, there's an intermediary that actually reaches you. And actually, you can look at us and say, we are one of the first big fintechs in the world, although we were formed 60 years ago. We're a big networked fintech. And some people very much simplify who we are because they think, well, it's not that difficult. You just move money from A to B, and you can kind of do that everywhere. But actually, in order to do that, what you need to be able to do is set up global standards that operate in the same way around the world. You need to be able to work with hardware companies that put all of those endpoints out there, all those terminals across the world. You need to be able to be connected up to every single bank in the world that can deliver payment services. So we're connected up to 45 million endpoints and practically every bank in the world. And this is the power of the network. And of course, over time, things are changing very fast. And it's not just what we're doing today, but what we're thinking of doing tomorrow when the world moves into conversational commerce. What does that mean? When the world moves into the Internet of Things, well, what does that mean? And things that we've done already, such as bringing the whole London Underground up into contactless payments, that was us working with the London Underground. And it took several years to get that project done. But on the first morning that we did it, 40,000 people walked through the barriers, either tapping their cards or their mobile phones, unaided, if you like, before 9 a.m. in the morning. I can tell you, TFL were falling off their chairs at kind of, is it really this easy? Well, of course it's not that easy. I mean, what you need to do is you need to change the underlying technology to get that to work. But once you've got it to work, the consumer adoption is so fast that today, 17 million journeys a week here in London, whether it's on the bus, on the tube, in a taxi, in an Uber, is done in a contactless way using your card or your telephone or whatever way you're doing contactless. And not only did that change the way that people moved through London, but it changed everything else beside. All of the little coffee shops in the station started operating that way. And I don't know about you, but I rarely wander around with cash these days in the UK. It's just so easy to do this stuff. And visitors, there are 19 million visitors to London every year, and they get off the plane and they're cards or mobile work in London seamlessly from all of many different countries they come from. On average, it's about 35 different currencies that are used on the London Underground every day, which is just astounding when you think about it. Can you remember the time you had to queue up to do foreign exchange at the airport. You bought too much money. You paid fees to do that. You handed some of it back at the end of the day. It was a complete mess. You didn't have the coins to go into the coin machines to buy the tickets, yada, yada. So the point being that this is transformative in the life of consumers. And we have 2.5 billion products out there across the world. So we reach many of the world's consumers. But to Nada's point about who are you, we have said we are a company that really cares deeply about financial inclusion. We said in 2015, we want to bring the next 500 million people into the financial system. So far, we've brought 370 million people in since 2015. And why do we do that? Well, we do it because we think it's the right thing to do, but we do it because it's a sustainable business model for us. Flow is the business that we're actually sitting in. That's who we are. We're part of a big technology company that's in the financial flow business, and it makes sense for us to connect people up around the world. And actually, if you have a value that's linked to your brand, a value in the sense of good social values, we find that incredibly compelling for recruitment. There are many people that want to join our firm because they see that we're doing well by doing good. And it's not just a gimmick or a tagline, it's reality. And by the way, one of the things we did when we IPO'd in 2006 at a value of $5 billion, we took 10% of our stock and we created MasterCard Foundation. It's an arm's length foundation, but as we grow, and our market cap's about $230 billion now, that foundation's worth $23 billion. So actually, it's fantastic because you've created something which lives on its own, but it also is MasterCard Foundation. It's part of the brand. We don't tell them what to do. They invest hundreds of millions in Africa, and people feel good in the company about what we're delivering. So that's like who we are, and that's how it links to the brand.
It's interesting what you said about doing well by doing good. That's, of course, hidden from most end consumers. They don't know this. So when we think about a brand, we want to think about all the facets of the brand, and you're not going to go out there with all the associations about the brand to the entire audience. So it's actually about managing a set of associations with different stakeholders in the ecosystem of customers. Now, while your direct customer is a business, of course, you're building the value to the end user. So you can kind of get this pull through. Rather than having a push strategy, you can have a pull on your brand. Well, how is the brand defined in the consumer's minds? And certainly in these sort of maybe uncertain times, how does it play out and how does it give you strength to your business?
Well, you mentioned a lot about trust when you were talking about brands. And you also mentioned safe. When, you know, what's safe, and people said Volvo and so on. But when you see those two circles together around the world, people feel that there is a safe way to do a transaction that's going to work in real time and that it will happen, that it's going to be delivered. You trust that it's going to be delivered. You trust that there's a certain safety in there. And that's what, you know, we hope that the brand means in the consumer's mind. The other thing about the brand, who thinks of the word priceless? Priceless, do you think about MasterCard when you think about priceless? You know, this is something that we've had for over 20 years. And our latest research showed us that people care much more about experiences than things. You know, you buy something, okay. But if you have an experience, you have a wonderful holiday with your family, you have a marvelous trip to the theater because you saw Hamilton, you went to the Brits, you went to the Champions League, these are very important things in people's lives. And lately, we've been evolving Priceless into that whole experiential part of our brand. Priceless surprises. Priceless experiences, priceless causes, if you're someone who cares about, you know, investing in social good. And this is something very interesting in the evolution of it.
And you track the strength of that brand when you negotiate with your customers as, you know, obviously It's about creating value for the end user, but that value then gets split up in the value chain. Do you recognize the value of that brand in those negotiations?
Oh, completely. And in actual fact, you know, we actually, because remember our customers, for example, typically banks, big corporations, governments, and so on, we talk about, you know, the brand being identified. We talk about how we can jointly market things, for example. Many of our assets we jointly market. And if you think about some of our sponsorships, we sponsor the Champions League, we sponsor the Brits here in London, we sponsor Cannes Film Festival, we sponsor the Open. And when we're dealing with banks, they obviously want to deliver some of the experiences due to these things. We sponsor the Rugby World Cup. They want to deliver those experiences to their consumers. And we package those up together and talk about, you know, priceless experience for the consumer. Although we don't directly market, well, we market to the consumer, but we don't sell to the consumer.
And the session sort of surviving, you know, that's sort of the title. But it sounds to me like MasterCard is more than surviving. You might be actually thriving in this disruptive world. And some of the things I learned yesterday, I don't know, how many of you have a Revolut card?
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Incubated by MasterCard?
Yeah.
Apple Pay, anybody?
Yeah.
Powered by?
MasterCard.
Okay. Maybe you could share a little bit about how you operate in this environment and how you manage to thrive rather than just survive, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. So you were asking me yesterday, Nader, about, you know, fintech disruption. A lot of people ask me this, and that's why I said we're the original fintech. But the point being, we don't think that we can develop everything ourselves. We think, actually, it's great to have a lot of startup activity happening, and London's fantastic from that point of view, by the way. And we actually help startups incubate. I think through our StartPath program, which we started in Dublin, which is where we started our first labs, and now we have labs all over the world, we've touched something like 10,000 startups in the last few years. And we've helped incubate hundreds of startups because we've said, look, we have a huge global network that you can piggyback on. Now start developing really cool applications and products that are going to appeal to the general public. Because actually, we're in the flow business. So if we help them be successful, then the business actually flows through our network. So it's a win-win situation. And so then the latest technology is out there, the latest thing being the Apple Pay with Goldman Sachs and Apple. But in order to actually get to Apple Pay, this is an interesting story because we were thinking, how do we create the rails of the future that are starting to be really safe to use for e-com around the world? How do you take away the card but make it a safe environment? And we came up with the idea that you need to tokenize the transaction so that your credentials, your information doesn't move from anywhere. That's locked into a token, and that token goes across the internet. That's very important for mobile. So we actually started thinking of that when we started to design Apple Pay. That then has become the standard for the way that we're working with all of the banks around the world, and it's making it just as safe to operate on the internet as it is to operate in the physical world. And we actually see that the physical and the digital world are actually combining, they're converging, if you like. And if you think about, people have said to me, what about disruptive people coming in the internet space and taking your space? My view is it's easier for us to move into the virtual world than it is for a company to do both virtual and physical the way that we do, because it's the physical piece, the hedgerow by hedgerow, as we call it, rolling out, you know, the infrastructure. That's the hard piece. Building something in the cloud and making it work around the world is relatively easy compared to that.
And in terms of looking forward, and this will be my last question to you before I open up to the audience, especially from a brand perspective, it's one of the biggest assets for MasterCard. If you think about, there's technology, but there is the brand. One of the pieces of research I'm doing is looking at how senior management views the brand once it appears on your balance sheet. So you've acquired a company, all of a sudden here's this huge asset which now sits there, it goes through an annual impairment test, and they're saying, oh my God, this is a big asset. Is it protected? Is it registered? What are the risk factors to the brand? So actually the discussion of brand is now finding its way into the boardrooms, which is kind of an interesting way that, you know, different questions are being asked of the CMO. What are the risks to the brand, maybe to the business, but if you have thoughts on the brands, and how do you go about protecting your brand as an asset and the reputation of your company?
Well, it definitely made it to the boardroom a long time ago in our business. And we have a fantastic CMO, Raja. And, you know, we think about the brand very much in the sense of reputationally protecting it. You know, we don't want to be involved in things that we don't want our brand associated with. So if we came across, for example, a site that was selling, say, child pornography, for example, we work with, you know, intelligence organizations around the world that help us close down anything like that. Because why would we be associated with anything like that? That's just the wrong thing to do. And reputationally, we just don't want to do anything like that. We also, in a probably less extreme scenario, I wanted to give you a very extreme scenario to begin with, but we think about how we present our brand in terms of how are, for example, women reflected in our advertising. And if you think about some of the brands in the past, I don't need to tell you that, you know, there's been some very poor reflections of that. So we actually monitor that, we measure it, we look at the way that we're presenting ourselves, and I hope that none of you have seen anything that you've, you know, associated with our brand that would be in any way demeaning, negative, or, you know, anything like that. So we do think of the brand really carefully in that respect. And we also think of very positive things. Obviously, our brand is associated with passion. So when we're thinking about priceless, we actually link into people's passions and we say, what do people really care about? You know, they care about experiences, but what kind of experiences do they care about? And we think about the arts and we think about sport and we think about travel, because a lot of, you know, traveling with your family is a wonderful experience. And it's kind of made us also think about cities and what do cities mean to people? Because sometimes cities are more important than countries. People think, I'm going to London, I'm going to New York, I'm going to Paris, I'm going to Hong Kong or Rome or, you know, and then what is the experience they have when they're there? What do they like to eat? You know, what, you know, do they like opera? Do they like music? Do they like a theater? And all of these things that we're thinking about associated with our brand, because our brand is what consumers want everywhere around the world. And that's what makes it so wonderful and so interesting in this business. Big technology business, but massive consumer brand. And that's actually the fun part.
So I'm assuming you learned something about MasterCard, but if there are any, would you like to take the questions directly?
Sure.
So go ahead, you select.
Yes, please.
My question, I used to work for MasterCard in terms of the advertising in Southeast Asia.
Oh, there you go.
I do know Raja.
And much more of an expert than me, I'm sure.
My question's around when Apple Pay did launch. What was the decision in not, say, co-branding with Apple? Because not many people do know that MasterCard was the payment technology that helped Apple out. And my second question, if you have time to answer it, is, what happens when Revolut gets done for compliance? Like today, there's the big thing that they've had some issues with the FCA. And, you know, MasterCard co-branded with Revolut in that situation. Can the brand survive? And what are your thoughts on that?
Okay. So in terms of Apple, we're more like Intel in terms of inside. As you know, we're an ingredient brand. And so the way that we went forward was, and you'll know if you use Apple Pay, and I'm sure you do, that when you use Apple Pay, actually that card comes up on your screen and you see our brand, if it's our brand card, could be another, but hopefully it's our brand card. And so you actually see that. That is the thing that we did, both for us and the bank. Because remember, in order to reach you as the consumer, it's actually your bank who gives you the credit, who gives you the account, who gives you the card, and they are the people that we're working through. So we thought about not just ourselves, not just us, the network, but how does the bank get recognition inside Apple Pay, which is kind of a good way of thinking. On the Revolut question, you know, we deal with many different companies, millions of companies around the world, tens of millions. And of course, you know, each company is responsible for how they work with their own regulator. So I don't think that actually reflects as much on the network. We are actually doing what we do in the right way every day. And, you know, different companies have to take responsibility for whichever way they're operating. Yes, please.
Hi, Anne and Nader. Thank you very much for the lovely introduction. My name is Tulika Jaiswal, and I'm from a social impact tech startup. I found your comment on financial inclusion very interesting, because that is what our startup is trying to do for women in India. What was the conscious choice, or was it a conscious choice, to make the financial inclusion bit that you mentioned from MasterCard an implicit element? And would that implicit element sustain as we, in the next few generations, where social impact is gaining much more momentum and consideration among the younger generation?
Yeah, it was absolutely a conscious choice. And we actually said, we actually sat back and we said, what is it that we're trying to do here around the world? 85% of the world's payments are made in cash, consumer payments. I'm talking numbers of transactions. And we said, really, we're trying to replace cash. And then we said, in order to replace cash, what does that mean? And, you know, if you go up to Scandinavia, it's practically all electronic. But if you go to India, you know, Southeast Asia, Africa, it can be practically all cash. And if you think about it that way, then you can think, how can I actually build an ecosystem that works and actually starts replacing cash? What do I need to do? And in order to start building that ecosystem, you have to include people. There's no point having, I mentioned the Internet of Things, there's no point having the Internet of Everything if you don't have the Internet of Everyone. Right? I mean, it's like, it's a logical progression when you start building out your business model. And so the reason I'm sort of going down this route is that I'm trying to say it's at the core of our business, the thing that we're trying to do. And inclusion is a natural, you know, it's an absolutely natural component of it. And so it will sustain. But in order to achieve it, you then start to say, if I have people living on $5 a day, why would they put money inside a telephone? Why wouldn't they just keep that money, right? You need to find a funding source that actually puts people's money into a card or into a mobile phone. What is that funding source? In most parts of the world, it's the government. Governments pay benefits to people. They pay farming subsidies, child benefits, pensions. There's something going on between the government and the people in their country. And if you can find those flows and you can make them electronic, you can then load the money into a card or into a telephone. And it starts this virtuous circle about inclusion. Once you've got that circle going, then people can start doing things with that electronic money that they could never do with cash. And for example, in Africa, we did a partnership with M-Copa, which is a company that does solar panels, these A3 solar panels, which will actually provide power for an African household. But most Africans can't afford to buy a solar panel off the bat. But we have created a pay-as-you-go scheme where they can pay for their solar panels through their telephones. And so once you've got the money loaded into something, there's all sorts of things that you can do around the world. And that's the way we think about inclusion.
Small message from a sponsor. M-Copa was started by Nick, one of our graduates. He also did M-Pesa.
There you go.
So.
You see, minds alive, diverse minds.
And I just wrote up a case and I taught it this morning with the SEP. So,
a slightly self-interested question, if I may. You mentioned the introduction of contactless on TfL, and I certainly agree that was a major breakthrough. Are we going to see this in other major cities in the world, particularly, if I can ask, New York? Because I visit there quite often.
You can ask, and the answer is absolutely yes, because once we saw how powerful the whole model was in London, and did I mention the 17 million journeys? Yeah, I did. So once we saw how powerful that was, we said, why don't we do this all over the world? And we actually have 150 projects on the go across many major cities in America, Australia, Russia, you name it, you know, where there's rapid transit systems, we're busy doing that. So watch this space. Yes, at the back.
Thank you for the insights. You know, I fully understand the model of a B2B to C, and that you've branded yourselves with Priceless a long time ago and you've associated with experiences. But, you know, as a consumer, you're many times given the choice. Visa, MasterCard, you go to your bank, you mentioned Revolut, you know. We talked about social impact just now. You've given us your, you know, a number of things you do on the entrepreneurship side, incubation, which you're doing in Africa right now. Had I known that, I don't think I would have, let's say, a competitor necessarily in my wallet. I think you may want to rethink a little bit rebasing. Obviously, the Priceless is one of the things that all of us around here have probably grown up knowing. But it may be worth, just as an insight, just, you know, it would make a difference. You know, obviously, your network, how you're building with the banks, the financial institutions, across borders, across systems, and fintech is important. But I think looking at the consumers in a different light, especially, you know, as the value system is changing in terms of what's important to people, could give you a different type of boost, especially in this age of disruption.
Oh, no, I completely agree with you. And I think, you know, the challenge is to get the consumer educated about everything that we're doing. That is a big challenge. The other thing that you have to remember is sometimes, you know, your bank will decide what you get. It depends on the geography. Some geographies, consumers have choice. In other geographies, it's basically what you're given.
Why not give it to the consumer, though? Can you not push that?
Well, it's our business model. You know, our business model is B2B, and there's many reasons behind this. And it's actually a really good business model, because if you think about the size of our company, 230 billion market cap, we only have 14,000 people around the world. We have a very good efficiency ratio. We have a very good growth curve. And this is because if you think about it, the front end, the distribution engine, is these millions and millions of banks and corporates and so on. So the network effect of our business is incredibly powerful. If we started competing with our main distributors and going direct to the consumer, it may not actually, in the end game, be so good.
But to follow up on that point, if I just may, I mentioned that a brand is a very multifaceted animal, the associations, and you leverage different parts of it with different audiences. One thing is getting into people's wallets, but you're mentioning getting it out of the wallet. I think most of us will have Visa, MasterCard, Amex, and probably something else in their wallet right now, and the game is changing. So one is, yes, if the consumer truly will act on that insight, how can we heighten that and say this company is doing well, assuming you're doing better than Visa and American Express, that is. And the other one is, it's very hard to get consumers to understand too many things about your brand. It's very difficult to try to communicate too many things, and that's why having a very precise message for an audience can be very powerful. So we also have to be careful not to dilute the message too much. But I think you're making a valid point. If the consumer is really going to act on taking the card out of their wallet based on, you know what, I'm going to have a bit of a social impact here, that might be a powerful way of doing it. The question is, how do you do that without confusing the consumer?
And I think that's a great point, Nader. And one of the things that we have done is work with the World Food Programme. And we decided that we would deliver 100 million meals for school children because it hit many sustainability goals, education, fight against hunger, fight against poverty, even equality, because people send their girls to school when they're going to be fed. Interesting point. So the thing is, the way that we did that, for example, Virgin Money, her MasterCard here in London, and they ran a campaign for 2 months saying every time you tap your MasterCard on the London Underground, one school meal goes to a child. And at the beginning, we said, you know, let's try and get 1 million taps, you know, over a couple of months. Well, we got 2 million taps in the first month because people actually love that. They go, there's a social thing. I want to do that. The other thing that we did when we first brought up the London Underground capabilities, we said, let's have fare free Fridays. So for those people who aren't tapping, just going through the barriers, let's say every Friday you get a free journey, fare free Friday. That actually caused a peak in demand, right? And it didn't drop off. The people, as soon as they started to tap, continued to. So these things are, but you're absolutely right, those are very simple messages. Tap, give a school meal. Tap, you get a free journey. It's that kind of message. It's not the sort of complexity of the big social maw, if you like.
So we have 1 minute left according to this little timer. So
why don't you choose? It's scary.
I choose maybe right in the middle because I know he's going to ask a very short question.
Does it really matter if your brand expands beyond its original premise? In MasterCard, you have the last four letters card. Yeah. And clearly you're moving to a future where there won't be a card involved.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of other brands, say like perhaps like Carphone Warehouse. Yeah. I mean, very few of us remember that was because you bought a mobile phone that's physically fixed to your car. And the reason I ask this, I'm working with health tech startups, and they're very focused on the initial thing it's going to do and try and establish a brand, and you just know within a few years it'll have moved on. Mm. So I'm interested about how you think about when to rebrand or when to just to stick with it.
Well, it's an interesting question, and you know, people in the audience might know that we've actually just dropped the MasterCard word from underneath the logo. And before we did that, and Nader started the conversation this way, we went out around the world and we asked people around the world, when you see this orange and red circle, what, you know, two overlapping circles, what does that mean? And they said, that's MasterCard. And then we took the colours out. We said, what does that mean? 80% still said, it's MasterCard. And we said, it's okay, we don't need the word MasterCard. These circles in people's mind mean MasterCard, like the M for McDonald's, like the tick for Nike, right? It's great, actually. And one of the reasons for driving that was thinking when you're making mobile payments on your mobile phone, there's not much real estate, there's not much space on that phone, is there? So if you can just have that logo and everybody knows what it means, it's really powerful. And then, of course, we're moving into sonic brands now because there's going to be conversational commerce. You will be buying things off your Alexa and Siri and whatever device Echo you've got. And then it's going to be important to have the sound. What's the sound? And what does that mean? And how does that work around the world? And so we've been testing all of that. We just launched the sonic brand. And by the way, and we're at zero here, and Nader can probably answer this question better than me, but the Sonic brand, it actually is a tune, a piece of music that we've tested out with lots of musicians in different parts of the world. It's the same notes, but they sound different according to what musical instruments you play them on, what tempo, how you put them together. And musicians have tested this out from China through India to the Middle East to Latin America to Europe. It's really fascinating, you know, the whole marketing space and how you think about these things. But yes, absolutely. I mean, we've actually dropped the words, which I think is so cool because, you know, our competitors, they don't have a logo. It's just...
Well,
it's just that word, and it's not necessarily a good word in Britain. You know, cash is a four-letter word.
I think a couple of quick examples. You mentioned Car Phone Warehouse. In the rest of Europe, it's called Phone House. So, but they assessed the brand in the UK, and they realized we don't want to drop it because people remember it as that. BP changed from British Petroleum to BP, supposedly beyond petroleum, but they haven't really moved beyond petroleum. So you can prepare for it in one way or another. But most significant, one of the most powerful brands in the industry, the London Business School. we have such a powerful name, and everything, it's so direct, you know, a business school in London.
Yeah.
And of course, we're in Dubai, we're in New York, we're in Hong Kong. So actually, it's a big debate we have about the London Business School. I mean, my solution is that one of you will give us about £250 million so we can rename it in your honor, because that will solve the problem. But actually, in the logo you'll see is the London used to be bold and bigger in the old logo, and we've made a subtle change to recognize that it's the spirit of London, which is the diverse community that we're in here, which really marks our place in the world. So we've made subtle changes. But I think the way we think about a brand, you do need words at the end of the name. Remember Prince? It was the artist formerly known as Prince, that weird symbol. Because that was a trademark dispute with Sony. You need a word. And that's why the brand name is so powerful at the end of the day. So I think it's an important question one needs to think about in terms of expanding their brand into the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This podcast was brought to you by London Business School, bringing you thought leadership from London Business School's global experts. For more insight and expert opinion, go to london.edu/LBSR.